Awesome to welcome Gunma Crane Thunder's head coach, Kyle Milling, to the Basketball Podcast. Milling is a seasoned professional basketball coach with extensive international experience. From 2013 to 2015, he served as an assistant coach at Air Toulon Varbasket in France's Pro B division, helping guide the team to the playoffs with a 17th ranked budget out of 18. Milling was promoted to head coach from 2015 to 2017. Under his leadership, the team won Pro B in 2016 with the lowest budget in the league, earning promotion to Pro A. In their first year at the top level, he managed to keep the team in France's first division, despite operating with the team's lowest budget. From 2017 to 2019, Milling led Limoges, one of France's most prestigious clubs. In his first season, Limoges reached Pro A semifinals and placed fourth overall. In 2020, Milling took his coaching expertise to Japan as head coach of Yokohama B Corsairs. There, he guided the club to the most wins in its B League history. From 2021 to 2024, he led the Hiroshima Dragonflies through a remarkable transformation. Taking over a team that had gone 9-48, he drove a turnaround that culminated in a B League championship in 2023-24. Under his leadership, Hiroshima posted records of 29-27, 42-22, and 42-26 across 3 seasons. He was honored as the 2023-24 B League Coach of the Year.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to Basketball Immersion's group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams. Get started now. Basketball Immersion Group Membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Kyle, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Hey, thank you. Appreciate it. It's an honor to be here and listen to you guys many times. So I feel honored to be able to give something back.
Well, humbled to have you here as well and be able to share, and we'll get right into a few topics. As we dive in, Kyle, maybe let's start with you've coached in France, you've coached in Japan. Maybe give our audience a little bit of a reference for the differences in those two leagues and from a coaching perspective.
The leagues are definitely a lot different, especially when it comes to the physicality and the athleticism. When I first got there, I brought over a lot of the things I did in France, and slowly I had to adjust because the style of play is different. The Japanese players are just as athletic. Technically and tactically, they're very good. It's just you don't have the 2 meters or the 6'8", 6'7" athletes who are going to be on the wings, especially, who can create that athletic difference.
You've talked about creating a team, and I love this reference that you're saying is that creating a team is your small business and you approach it that way. Can you help us expand on that understanding?
Yeah, I think even from when I was in France, I really tried to treat everyone equal. And I think a team, it's not just one player, two players, three players are going to give you something. I've always, the strongest teams is basically 1 through 12 deep, as well as a strong staff. So I've always used a reference many times about creating my team is almost like managing a restaurant, where if you want the restaurant to survive, you can't just have like one good cook or one good manager, but you need obviously a leader, someone to lead the restaurant, but you need the assistant cook, you need the waiter, you need the busboy, you need a little bit of everyone. And then respecting everyone and everyone's job just as important as the other person's. So if you don't have a good busboy or a good waiter, then obviously the service isn't going to be as good and things aren't going to work right. So it's really building a team, building a staff where everyone's job is just as important as the other person's, as well as the players from your first player down to the 12th player down. Everyone has an important role. And talking about their roles and then giving value to that role too when things are successful or when they perform well.
Do you use that analogy for the team, for the players themselves? Do they understand that analogy, or is it something different for them?
Every once in a while, I'll talk about it more just having an important role. But maybe one or two teams I've used that analogy before, but it's not something I always do. But
You referenced bringing value to a role. What are some things that as coaches and as you particularly can do to bring value to a role?
I think one of the most important is probably a lot of communication with the individual, expressing one what their role is, and then not just individually, but when they're successful or when they execute what we really want in their role, not just telling them individually, but as well as in front of a group. I communicate a lot of individually, but I like to do a lot of group communication as well, where you're giving value to an individual in front of the group, because I think that helps a person feel good. It's not just me saying or one coach saying it. It's them getting recognition from the entire group that they're important, they're being successful as well. So.
Love that. And that's particularly important, obviously, in some of the different changes in rosters and changes in organizations and changes in teams, to be able to express your differences in terms of the different roles and the different types of approaches that you take for them. But maybe shape it for us first. I know you got fired in your job in Limoges, so maybe talk to us a little bit about that process of getting fired. We probably don't talk about it enough, but it is a reality, especially of professional coaching, isn't it?
Yeah. No, it was, I think it was my fourth year as a head coach. And the first 3 years, I had pretty good success. And that fourth year in Limoges, I went there knowing Limoges is one of the most famous teams in France, but also, I don't know exactly the stats, but I think they're on 21 coaches in 29 years or 29 coaches in 21 years. So it's basically the length of a coach is less than a year or just over a year or something. So I went there knowing it's going to be difficult, but I learned a lot from it because I got fired, but I'd kept a lot of the same things I did in that second year. The first year we had a great year. We probably made too many changes because we wanted more. So I learned too to be to, you always want more, but at the same time, sometimes you got to be happy and with what you have as well. And so we made a few too many changes. And then I tried to keep a lot of the same things I had done that was successful the year before with a new group. And with that group, it didn't work as well. And then in Limoges, when basically you have to win. So you lose a few games and then things go off. So I did learn a lot about adapting to the group more and learning, making adjustments both tactically as well as management with the different groups I had. And so it was a hard moment because my family, the first year in Limoges, they stayed in the south of France because I knew it was going to be difficult. So I said, stay 1 year and we'll see how it goes. And then the second year, they all moved up to Limoges, changed schools and everything. And it lasted a few months. And so it was a difficult time on the court, but as well as off the court with the family situation and changing everything. So.
No doubt those challenges of that. And for you personally, then, and maybe shape it for our audience, how much of professional coaching is managing the management as much as it is managing the players?
Yes. I say or think tactically, obviously, there's some teams play better than the other ones. But if you look at the French league, many teams run the same type of thing. The Japan league is a little bit more diverse because there's so many different kinds of styles of play and different coaches from different areas. But if you watch the different leagues around Europe, usually the French teams kind of have a certain style. Spanish teams have a certain style. So I think really puts the coaches over each other, or like the most successful ones are the ones who can really manage the group and the off-court stuff. Tactics is to me 20% of the job, and basically managing the group and trying to get the best out of them is about 80% of the job.
So what about specifically dealing with management? Are you selling things to management constantly throughout the season, educating them about what you're doing and why you're doing that? Is that a big piece so that they understand?
Yeah, but I think it goes to different cultures as well. Like in the French league, probably wasn't so much, but in the Japan league, there's a lot of they care a lot. I think maybe modern as the basketball is growing as well too, but the numbers, statistics and numbers, and they put a lot of emphasis on the numbers in Japan. So showing the improvements as well as things you want to improve and as well as our negative points too. But trying to communicate with the management, trying to show progress is the things we're trying to work on. Numbers statistically wise for many stats.
Well, I love that. And I know numbers are a big part of your kind of philosophy as well. These statistical objectives, whatever they may be, I assume they change from team to team a little bit, but is there any consistency in the kind of the statistical objectives that matter to you as a coach?
Well, I think especially when I get to the new team, the first couple of things I really want to work on is the rebounding and the defensive end of it. Because I think that's something, many coaches say, that's something you can control in a way. So especially the defensive aspect of the game. Trying to install the culture, a defensive culture with a rebounding culture is something I really try to concentrate on in the beginning. Especially with a new team, you don't maybe always know the team exactly how you want to put them in place offensively. But I think defensively and the rebounding aspect is something, a mindset you can set from the very beginning. And for example, Gouma this last year, the year before, I think they... And there's many different defensive statistics. They're around the 18th or out of 24 the year before. Rebounding, too, they're near the bottom. And we really concentrated on this year, and we finished basically in the top five in most defensive statistics and rebounding. We got not in the top five, but we did get up in the top 10. So it was a big boost the first year. And so we want to build off that in the second year coming up.
What are some of those tactics defensively that you value and then add value to your team?
For example, this year when I got to Goomer, we analyzed some different things that they weren't good at last year, which one was finishing possessions. They had one of the worst PPPs at like end of possessions. This year, especially with Goomer, concentrate on finishing possessions, finishing the rotations. And same, I've adapted the defense as well year to year a little bit, depending on the personnel, between if you can hard hedge someone or you have a slower five, bigger five, as well as the guards in Japan are different. So the tactics have to adjust a little bit. But putting a lot of emphasis on the team defense, it's not just one person, but finishing possessions, rotating is one. And we always talk about being on the same page. We want everyone doing their job. Do your job. So it's the most important thing.
You reference determining based on your personnel a little bit what you're going to do defensively. What would be something that would trigger you defensively to be able to say hedge ball screens versus say, I don't know, switch ball screens, depending on the personnel? What would that be that determinant?
But obviously, the speed and athleticism starts, well, for me, but defense in a pick and roll situation starts on the ball. So I put more pressure. I was a big guy myself. Many coaches put a lot of pressure on the big guys all the time, but I try to put the pressure on the guard to do their job first. But so obviously, some of it depends on who's defending the ball, the physical level of the on-ball defender. But the big guy, whether they're, we had Caleb Tarzewski this year, who was great, very athletic, mobile, big, who can move. So we can, and he was a very smart player too. So we could adapt our pick and roll defense with him. Just their quality, their athletic qualities, and their different physical capabilities will make the adjustments defensively.
So I know in terms of coaching in general, but part of your philosophy is building confidence and getting players to obviously be able to see themselves as value. So talk to us a little bit about this process. How do you as a coach help players build confidence?
Yeah. I think one thing I've always, throughout the years, I've liked working with the younger players and having younger teams. This year in Goomer, we have one of the oldest teams, so that was an adjustment for me. But working with the players and one, finding their strengths and trying to put them in a position where they're using their strengths to their maximum, where they're great drivers, great shooters, concentrating on what they do best and having them trying to concentrate on doing that. And a lot of times guys want to work on 10 different moves or have 10, and it's always good to progress to get to that point. But if you want to play confidently, you got to be able to do one or two things good or great. And talking with the players individually and finding what their true strengths are individually, and then giving value to that too when they do it right. And then I think putting them in the best positions to be successful in their individual strengths is what helps to build that confidence. And then I coach very positive as well. Good, good, great. Always giving positive information, positive feelings to help build them throughout the year.
So connect that for us. You're arriving at a new club, say Gunma, and you're setting a style or a culture. Where do you start in that area, being able to set those two things? And then obviously that builds into building confidence for the players and the team.
Yeah. Beginning, like I said, try to find their roles, but truly always teaching that giving value to each player and trying to have everyone involved in what we're doing and giving value to each player's role, creating a team environment where together as one, we're going to do something successful. It's not, especially in Japan, where you have three imports and then nine Japanese. Some of the teams, usually the league leading scorers in Japan usually finish near the bottom. And the teams with more team basketball, where they're 10, 15 points a game with five different scores, the other ones are finishing near the top. So when I first get there, talk about what winning teams do and how they play and the chemistry and all, basically being all everyone on the same page and everyone striving together and then making sure everyone feels just as important as the other player.
What do winning teams do in your mind?
What do they do? They have incredible team chemistry. They believe in each other. They share the ball. They play hard. They trust each other. Trust and belief is a couple words that I use a lot. Not just trusting what the staff wants, but trusting their teammates and believing in themselves, but believing in their teammates, believing in the coaching staff. So we talk about that a lot as well, as trust each other, believing in each other, and then building those relationships where I always say, I always want to work hard. We do work hard, but I think I try to make it too where they're enjoying what they're doing. I want to work hard, but at the same time, enjoy what they're doing. And I think in any job, if you enjoy what you're doing, you're always going to give that extra thing. You're going to do that extra thing for the person next to you or for your boss or for somebody else. So my father was an orthopedic surgeon. That's what he always wanted to be growing up. And he told me, I was like, he never went to work one day in his life where he didn't enjoy what he did. And some people, oh, he worked a long time too. And people wanted him to retire, but he just kept working because he enjoyed what he did. I think part of it too is creating an environment where the players as well as the staff enjoy what they're doing. And I think that helps too, to bring out a mentality where you can do anything for your teammate, for your coach, for your staff, for the club, for that.
You've shaped a lot of this for us in terms of the culture, and then you being positive as a coach and the different things that go into obviously developing your team and developing your players. Can you help us understand what does a Coach Milling practice look like?
What does it look like? We do go hard and intense, but we start off and I try to implicate, especially all the staff. So we try to have each staff, have a certain role in the practice as well. And I've worked with the same assistant now 4 to 5 years, and he's kind of like the bad cop, good cop. But no, my practices, I try to get there early. Well, the guys are always there early, but get out of my office a little bit early and try to at least individually talk to a little, nothing about basketball, but I try to get a little touch individually with each player about their families, what they do, their girlfriends, whatever they do the night before. Try to get a little relationship creating every day, try to something, and then I think that help it builds. And then we start practice and get it going. But when I got to Guma, for example, the strength coaches were, they kept talking about it was Japanese to the English, but it was a high intensity, high intensity. But at the same time, go hard, have fun, and then enjoy what you do, get back to the next day.
Love that. And it sounds like a great environment to be able to play in and to be able to develop in. And you referenced a little bit the defense about adapting your style and adapting a little bit to your personnel. Talk to us on the offensive end, particularly sometimes the difference in choice for you to play at a high pace versus a slower pace, depending on your roster.
Yes. Especially the last few years, I think I've had to adapt. Once again, trying to adapt. I learned a lot from Limoges when I did get fired, and I try to bring the same offense. Like many times, like when I've had my job interviews, what's your style of play? And it's even in Guma, I try to say it's a style. I want to play the modern day five out running, 3-point shooting, stuff like that. But I wanted to adapt to the roster I have. My first year in Hiroshima, we had two 5 men, two classic fives. You can't play stretch ball or pick pops, or so you had to adapt the offense, more inside stuff, more set plays as well. In the second year, we made some changes where we had basically stretch bigs, and then we started running more. Our pace was near the top, and we adjusted, and that's how I want to play. And this year, we got to Guma, and the roster was set. So once again, we didn't have stretch bigs, which is fine. So we adjusted the offense a little bit. Our pace was slower, but some of it was because we had longer possessions. It wasn't necessarily we walked the ball up the court, but we had longer possessions. Defensively, too, we had longer possessions, which makes the possession game a little bit, less possessions in the game. But our efficiency was near the top as well. Maybe a little slower pace, but adjusting the style of play and as far as where the emphasis of where you want to put the ball, depending on the roster, to try to keep the same efficiency over the last few years. What we did this year to what I did last year was very different, and the efficiency was close to the same, basically.
The goal is efficiency, obviously, in terms of that. Depending on your roster and depending on the personnel, you're shaping what you're doing, particularly maybe around the set play-oriented nature that you had to go to a little bit. What are some things that you valued in terms of those set plays and some actions maybe that you think are more effective nowadays with the type of players that you're coaching?
Yeah. I think this year, especially in Guma, even last year, once you got the stretch stuff, a lot of guard-to-guard stuff, a lot of go screens. This year, we had an import to 3-man Trey Jones. So he was a finisher, so end of game. And put him in actions as well, making him a screener, creating mismatches, finding. I learned a lot from the Paris coach, who's now in Memphis. Watched him a lot. Headhunting, the weakness on defense. That's what we try to work on that a lot and talk about a lot of before games. It's finding the weakest defender, putting him. Getting him involved in the action as much as possible. And from there, creating an early advantage by headhunting the weakest defender and coming on that guy screening or someone screening for him, creating a mismatch somewhere, but then moving the ball from there to be able to create an advantage with an early advantage. So.
How are you identifying for your players the matchup to hunt? And then secondly, how are you communicating that? Is it on the floor? Is it in scout in advance? A little bit of both? And then how is that communication method working?
Yeah, I think it starts with the assistants and our video analyst guys, especially in Japan. We play a lot of games. There's always two or three guys working 1 week before, or the one game ahead, and two, three guys working on the next game. So between waiting the scouting report, and then I always watch a game or two, and communicating with the staff first, the style and what we want, and talking about creating those mismatches, finding them, and then the scouting reports, talking about it, and then maybe making small adjustments in a few of the shorter plays we have to create those mismatches, to pick on the certain one, and then we go from there. So a lot of communication with the staff, but as well as the players, and then as well as feedback when things work, especially in the beginning of the year, especially in Guma and in Hiroshima as well, the start years with the new groups, doing a lot of feedback after games when things work, to showing the players what we want, what we wanted, and then when we do it right, how it can be successful. And I think that helps to gain confidence and belief as well as with the players.
What does it look like when you do it? The simple thing is to say, I beat my check and I go score. But the reality is, a lot of times, obviously, you're not necessarily scoring at the primary point of attack. So, talk to us about how you're managing that aspect of it, the ability for your players to be able to play off the ball versus attacking a matchup.
Yeah, it's more the execution of what we want. It's not even, I actually like to show good images is when we miss shots almost, because like the great execution and miss shot, hey, it's a great shot, no problem. But the execution and where we want the players on the floor, the movements between creating a mismatch, someone cutting, and getting to the right spots on the floor. And so showing the execution part of it more than the finishing, or hey, we scored. And I don't really care. I would say I don't care about scoring the ball. You just do things right. Execute right, move the ball right, get to the right spots. And then in the end of the year, things will work out well. So.
It's such a great point, and I love that. And I try and do that at certainly at the youth levels to show players examples where we did the right thing and we still didn't score. And that just happens. And that's a reality. That's something that's normal. So I love that aspect of it. What are some other ways that you use film, particularly in Japan, where the barrier of communication is there as well? Some ways that you use film to help communicate some of your points?
Yeah, like I said, some of it starts with the assistants as well. Communicating a lot with the assistants and them understanding what I want. So, like in Japan, with the communication barrier, our Japanese assistants, they do a lot of individual video as well with the Japanese players. And I'm there sometimes, but to help them create relationships with the players, and then trusting the assistants with them understand what I want. So, we do a lot of individual feedback. Same, not just the bad stuff, but the many good things is when they do things right, when they're doing things what we want, showing them, hey, this is what we want. And then, so it starts with individual. And then we do the collective one as well, where I try once again, I do some of it, but the assistant leads it. And then I'll chime in when I need to do more.
Of course. Do you know which lineups and player combinations are the most productive? Hoopsalytics has the most comprehensive lineup analysis system available. Coaches can see how each group performs offensively or defensively or excels in special situations. For example, if you need to force a late game turnover, you can see which group has the best defensive turnover percentage or see which four athletes work best with your star player. And you can do the same team-based analysis for groups of two or three players as well. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Discover how Hoopsalytics can help you make better data-driven coaching decisions. Visit hoopsalytics.com today to learn more. And you mentioned the differences in kind of the age of rosters, that you've had some variability in terms of that. So maybe just help us understand, what are some effective ways to coach older players versus effective ways to coach younger players? And again, most teams are mixed a little bit, but you've had two kind of contrasting rosters recently.
Yeah, in Hiroshima, I had one of the youngest teams, if not the youngest team in the league. And then in Gunma this year, we had the oldest team. I think a lot of it was the biggest difference. Obviously, practice load was one of the biggest things. So we had to reduce just a little bit. We had Michael Parker on the team, who has had an incredible career. He's 43 years old. He still runs like a 25-year-old. But we had to control the practice load and the management too. The young players, or the motivational part of it, young players, it's not easy, but you can always use the prove yourself. You haven't done it before. You want to do it. Where the older guys, a lot of them have been very successful and had great careers. So then I had to build it, where try to build that chemistry where we still wanted to be one and do it all together, and get them on a championship type mentality where they're a little bit higher goals, maybe you could say, getting them on the same page. But same as it was different this year than what I had as far as the energy in practice, maybe a little less too. So it's a different vibe. You had to adjust to the staff too, had to adjust to the players' rosters.
You've indicated a few times where when you've taken over certain places, the roster's been basically set. So you haven't had as much input. In most situations, then going into your second year or beyond, are you having more input into the roster? And then if so, what is the ideal roster for Coach Milling?
Yeah, the first last couple teams I've been on, almost three teams, I didn't have the input when I first got there. The second year, much more input. They've trusted many things I've wanted or my opinion and style. So same in Japan. Europe's a little different where the budget is, coaches are much more involved in the budget and prices of the players and negotiating. But in Japan, it's I give my opinion and the budget is salaries. I have no input or nothing with that. So I have gave the input, and most of the changes have been pretty close to what I said. My ideal team, I do want, especially in Japan, because it's different than in Europe, but I have big men who can do handle, create versatile big men, basically two, four, fives, both who can create and handle the ball. And then my goal always in Japan is to try to get positionless basketball, but it's a little bit harder with the size of the players. But I like everyone. I even my Japanese, I say positionless from the 1-2-3, as far as the ball handling goes, as much as possible, five handlers and a couple guys on the bench, high energy defensive players, dead eye shooter coming off the bench as well. Some bench coming off bench, someone who can change the pace of a game. And one game it's them, but the next game is going to be somebody else. But try to get to the positionless type basketball where everyone can do many different things on the court, basically.
You referenced, and I've had it referenced a little bit from some coaches in your league, that you run some good stuff, some good actions, and some effective kind of counter type actions as well. So maybe we talked a little bit about kind of the body of the sets and stuff like that, but help us understand, how do you build kind of multiple options or reads into kind of your set plays without overwhelming players?
Yeah. But I think many of our sets have many options and reads. So when especially when I first got to Japan or the newer team, when it come to a new team, especially some of the Japanese players have not struggle in the beginning because I say you say go there, but go there. I say, yeah, but if you go there, you can go there, you know, too. And then after reading behind it, a lot of it is repetition, a lot of drills, 3-on-0, 4-on-0, 5-on-0, okay. But we start, like you asked about how we start our practice. We start a lot of our practices with the fundamental type stuff, but offensively as well as defensively, but creating the different reads by doing it 3-on-0, 4-on-0, but reading each other and creating that read and react from everything.
So with that, then, do you use masking actions to disguise your sets? And then what are some different ways that you adapt your sets throughout the season?
As far as adapting the sets, especially this year and every year, pretty much, many times, even now, I'm thinking all about next year. But how we start the year to how we finish the year is usually very different or can be very different because I have an image or a vision of what I want. And that's what I've kind of learned throughout the years is a vision of kind of what I want. And as the year goes by, okay, this works, this doesn't work, that one goes in the trash, it's add this, a little twist to this. And trying to always add and adapting as the season goes too. And I think that makes us a little bit less predictable because we are doing different stuff. And this year in Goomba, for example, we had almost two different types of lineups. When five guys were on the, I had a sheet of paper. One sheet was when basically five guys were in, and I flipped the sheet and had another set, whole different, basically things we wanted to run with a different group. So that was not always easiest in practice trying to organize it all, but in the end, it worked out pretty good.
Definitely a big challenge, and something for coaches to think about is sometimes, even as we know in the NBA, if you remove one player, then the offense changes. So you think about Jokic with Denver, like it's a completely different offense to a certain extent when he's off the floor. So adapting to those two things is a really important part of coaching, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Because I don't know if we would have done what with one group, what we did with the other group, I guarantee you would be we wouldn't have been successful. Same thing, adapting to the two different groups, or different type of styles, but then now as well as showing it after, because some guys are like, oh, I can play with him. Like, I know you can probably play with him, but we're better when this type of group. And then showing in a video, talking about the stats, showing the players statistical things too with the different groups in and how we're performing different levels. So.
How are you organizing your play calls so that players, so that one, you can communicate, your staff can communicate them effectively, and your players can consume the information and execute it?
Yeah. Well, I think same have to adapt to the different groups. Certain players or can control the game themselves or call the plays and run the plays, the offense a little bit better. than some other players. So it depends, and have confidence doing it. Some players don't feel confident calling players. The offense are looking to the coach or looking to me to make the calls. So it depends on the team I have, or as well as the players on the court. So sometimes I do call stuff, but sometimes it's almost just automatic. The players are running it. So it's adapting to who's on the court and the team as well. So.
One of the challenges, of course, in running sets is that you have some lag time from transition into the set type of play sometimes. So talk to us about that. What are you trying to do in terms of you get the ball, say the other team scores, you get the ball. What are you trying to do first in terms of transition and then flowing into kind of set actions?
Yeah. But what I'm talking about, we never want anyone to walk, no walking the court, no walking the ball up and calling a set play. So we try to minimum some type of pace running into things. And then we talk about at least whoever is handling the ball, analyzing who's on the court and then who's in what position, where there is a guy on the strong side already, a guy on the weak side, the different. This year we had three or four different kinds of flow offense with different calls behind it. So if it's a strong side corner, weak side corner, if the big guy's bringing up, if the guards are double drag. So it's up to the guards to call the different plays as they go. Or myself, if it was after a make, is always a little bit more time to make the call, as well as depending on the arena, someone can actually hear me, or if it's a
Some great crowds in Japan. I know I watched a few games and certainly a lot on Synergy over the year, and really good crowds and really active crowds and a lot of fun to probably coach in, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the game's really growing in Japan, and the fans love it, and they put a lot of money and a lot of energy in the show around the game. There's always noise, there's always speakers, sometimes it's a little too much, but it is a fun atmosphere, so.
No doubt. You referenced like in Hiroshima, it being just a little bit different for you in terms of the roster and everything like that. But also, what was different was that you were told you were not coming back in the middle of the season and got to coach out the rest of the season. So, maybe talk to us about that challenge of doing that. But part of it may be good in the sense that you knew that you were looking for a job earlier than maybe others, right?
When I went to Hiroshima, I knew the situation. Basically, I was going there, and the plan was one of the players was going to take my spot. So whether it was going to be after year two, or after year three, or at some point that was going to happen. So on my third year, they told my agent basically mid-November. They like to do things early, super early, as far as the roster staffs things. So I knew early, and I accepted it. I knew it was going to happen, so it wasn't a surprise, and there was no negativity. I had a great relationship with the GM and everybody. So it was hard though at the same time, because I had a great 2.5 years there, knowing I was going to leave. And then eventually the rumors started getting out, especially within the team. So it was management wise, but the management didn't want me to say anything. They didn't really say that, but they were trying to keep it quiet. And then as the year went on, I felt a lot of noise going on. So eventually, I told the team that I would be leaving at the end of the year. And that was like a click to get everyone on the same page, to be honest and be open. And I think I did it in maybe in March, early March. So still a few months to go in the season. And it was kind of like a click that, because we had a great group and everyone was believing. But I think being honest and open and not trying to hide anything was a little click that helped us have a great end of the year.
And were you mentoring this player to be able to take over?
No.
It was just known that this was going to happen.
Yeah, he had been there 7, 8 years, and it was just like known that's what was going to happen. The team made him, at least on their website, that he was supposed to be an assistant coach, but he wasn't an assistant coach. He was still playing or whatever. It was a different situation, but
You coach long enough, you have some really unique situations, don't you?
yeah, for sure. So I don't know
Especially
if
in some of
I
these
want it again,
places.
but it was a different situation. It was hard mentally too, because losing your job or changing your job, it's not always easy. But then working with coaching the person who was going to take your job was not always easiest as well. So it was a mental challenge to stay calm, to stay positive, to stay energetic, and still be myself, even though it was a little difficult situation.
You referenced before your family and some of the challenges of your family moving or not moving and all the different things that go into that. And maybe for coaches listening, help them understand some of the ways that you found best to be able to manage that relationship with your family while managing your coaching career.
Yeah, I think been lucky too, because my wife, she's always supported everything decision I've made, many in the coaching business. First I went back to the States, and then I came back to France, and when I went to Limoges and even to Japan, she's always been very supportive. So it starts there. And then it's helped the last few years because my boys are, and my daughter, they're older, they're out of school. So it's been easier to move around, but it's still hard. So FaceTime obviously helps a lot, but they know it's my passion and my love too, the coaching and then moving around and changing environments, changing cultures is something I like. So having that support and their understanding is the most important. And,
Where have they remained? Do they have a home base now where they stay and then you move?
Yeah, our home base is France, and my wife is French. And then she comes to Japan 5 or 6 months of the year, and then I'm home a couple months of the year. And then we're young grandparents as well. I'm important, but the granddaughter and grandson are even more important. My wife stays a few months in France to be with them as well.
Yeah, fun, no doubt. And it adds a little bit of challenge to the coaching journey that you're on. I know that. But nevertheless, a great experience for everyone involved. And I mentioned earlier your assistant coaches, and you've had one that's been consistently with you, it seems, over the last few years, of course. Talk to us in general about managing your coaching staff at the professional level, and particularly around trusting your assistants and letting them help you do some of the work.
Yeah. Well, I think especially in Japan, we have big staffs. So and with the language barrier, it can be not the easiest at times. So it's very
How
important
big
to
would your staff be, coach?
well, I have 3 assistants, 2 video analysts, 3 trainers, 2 strength coaches, and 2 managers. So basically we're 13, 14 people total in staff.
Plus your interpreter.
Yeah, plus the interpreter. So 14, 15 total staffs. Basically, we travel with a bigger staff than we have 12 players, and we have more staff than players. The same, a lot of communicating before practice. First year in Hiroshima, I didn't have staff meetings. Started doing staff meetings a lot, like full staff meetings once or twice a week just to get on the same page. And that helped a lot, the communication part of it, instead of doing the individual strength coach meeting, head coaches meeting. And then obviously, I have a philosophy and many things I want to work on or ways how I want to work, but I try to adapt to especially this year, first year in Guma, I didn't make too many changes in how the staff functioned so much because I wanted to adapt to them as well and have them adapt to me. So taking time and trusting them and how they work, because I want them to feel comfortable in what they do. Like my assistants, they always say, "What do you want, coach?" And we want to work pick and roll or work against hard hedge. You do what you want to do and feel comfortable doing. Because if they try to do some exercise I like, for example, maybe they're not going to be comfortable doing it. So I want them feeling comfortable and working in a comfortable environment. And then after we can talk about it, maybe I can say, "Hey, why don't you add this to it or do that to it?" But really trying to get them to be comfortable in what they do and working comfortably. And I think that helps them have confidence. So like any coach, if they're not confident, players won't believe in it either. So I want them feeling confident on the court when whatever exercise they're doing. So doing what I want, but doing it in their way.
What are some things you're doing to prepare for this upcoming season? Again, we've referenced this before in the podcast. The Japan season is pretty long, so you don't have that long of a break. But what are some things that you're doing to get yourself ready?
We made some adjustments on the roster. So when I'm watching a lot of video of the guys on Synergy and stuff, I know most of them, but even I know 2 of them really good. But the guys who were assigned to watching a lot of Synergy, once again, trying to see what they're good at, what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. And then watching a lot of videos or basketball, trying to learn new ideas. And then that's more individual growth, you could say, trying to find new things and new ways to learn, management videos and books as well. And then as far as the staff, we've made a lot of changes in the staff as well. So I've been communicating with the staff, trying to build a little culture. It's a little hard on Zoom all the time, but so a little personal growth as far as basketball stuff goes and trying to see the little way. I've already analyzed the stuff we did last year and the strong points and the weaknesses and how we want to get better again. But now I'm diving into the new guys we have and trying to find their strengths and weaknesses.
Coach, you've obviously fallen in love with coaching internationally, and maybe shape that for us a little bit and give coaches that are listening, maybe that have aspirations to maybe coach overseas, some insights in terms of that process and then also the longevity and the sustainability that you've been able to achieve, which is really a significant thing. And the more I do the podcast, the more I learn that one of the things that I value the most from coaches is those that have sustained a career, especially across different places, different platforms, and different ways.
Yeah, coaching overseas has been. I lived overseas for a long time before, so it kind of prepared me to deal with the different cultures. But I really enjoy meeting new people, integrating new cultures. And I think in the coaching world, in order to be successful, one of the main things is being able to your adaptability to the different cultures. Because in Japan, even in Europe, you can say any culture is different. So there's been some coaches who head over to Japan, and the ones who are able to adapt to the culture, but at the same time keeping your values, but you have to be able to adapt to their culture as well. So finding that balance, it's a difficult balance to find. I can't really give a secret to it, but being able, open-minded to how things work in a different country, taking things that they like and how they work and how they're successful, and then adding what you can do and finding that balance in the mix. But I think that's the most important thing, to be successful overseas. And then has it been, especially, it's a little difficult when you have younger children, but if you have younger kids, but as your kids get older, I really enjoy moving around, seeing new cultures, meeting new people, and creating relationships in different spots. So.
Within both France and Japan, like from the different clubs or the different regions, the culture has been significantly different as well.
It's always a whole different people. France is a big difference between, for sure, the south of France, and you get to Limoges, their interactions. And of course, the Japanese culture is a lot different too, going from different clubs and how the clubs work. Hiroshima was maybe the management's a little bit more present. We're in Guma. The management is basically based in Tokyo, an hour and a half away. So it's a little different style as well, as far as how you're working with people.
We super appreciate you sharing with us, and we super look forward to watching where you end up next, Coach. But we do hope that you stay for a while where you are and have great success. And I know the league is expanding next year, or going to a new format as well. The challenge has increased. I think you're going to 26 teams. Is that right?
Yeah, the league's growing, and I think they're open up to even get bigger. But hopefully, it won't get too big, because then the talent pool always diminishes as far as the local players or whatever.
But a great time to be involved in Japan basketball, is it?
Yeah, no, the league's, I've been there to be my sixth year, but from the first year to now, the league's really exploded. Not just the level of play, but all the show of the games, the fan base, everything's really keeps growing. So, and they're putting a lot of effort into growing the game, and I think it's good for Asia. So growing the game out there even
Love it.
bigger.
And we appreciate you sharing with us, Kyle, and all the best.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks again for having me, and wish everyone a great summer and a great season next year.